Of the approximately 50 million military deaths in World War II, many of those didn't occur in combat, but had to do with nature. Some died from cold exposure, others, like pilots, died due to inclement weather, like rain or fog, or perhaps naval servicemen died in a storm. That was the case of the auxiliary ship, the USS Macaw. On January 16, 1944, the Macaw, a submarine rescue vessel, ran aground at Midway Atoll while attempting to tow the stranded submarine USS Flyer. The Flyer was pulled free 6 days later, but another 3 weeks of salvage efforts, plagued by rough seas and equipment failures, failed to dislodge it. As the Macaw slowly sank, the 22 sailors on board sought refuge in the pilot house, but by the following afternoon, the compartment was almost completely flooded. The captain gave the order to open the port side door and make for the foremast. Three men succeeded, but most of the others were swept overboard. Five of them died, including the captain. To tell us this story is today's guest, Tim Lawton, author of A Strange Whim of the Sea, The Wreck of the USS Macaw, and a son of one of the crew members. In this episode, we also look at the underreported role that auxiliary vessels played in the war, and look at an untold story of struggle, sacrifice, death, and survival in the World War II Pacific. Hope you enjoy this discussion with Tim Lawton. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Can you tell us what was happening in 1944 in the Midway Atoll? Give us the big picture of what's happening at this stage of World War II in the Pacific.
Right. Midway, of course, had been the site of the Battle of Midway, but that was in early June of 1942. By 1944, the main military value of Midway for the Americans was as a refueling depot for submarines going on patrol in the Western Pacific over closer to Japan. And it was very valuable that way because submarines were coming from Pearl Harbor. It's about 1,100 miles to Midway. So they were able to top off with fuel at Midway and give themselves that much more range for their patrols.
And just to get a sense of how much the war had shifted and the sites of conflict between the U.S. and Japan had moved in those two-year period, about how far is Midway from battles that are taking place at this time in the war?
Well, probably for most of the significant action, it's probably a good 1,500 miles. By 1944, the Americans were proceeding up, I think, the Solomon Islands. They were island hopping. There were various island chains that they were taking from the Japanese. The farthest flung Japanese installation, I think, during the war was at Tarawa. The Macaw almost got sent to Tarawa. Tarawa lies more or less on a line between Funafuti, which was a base in the, which islands are those? I want to say the Solomons, I'm not sure, but it's a little northeast of Australia, and Pearl Harbor. And when the Macaw left Funafuti in, I believe that was November of 43, it went to Pearl Harbor. It went past Tarawa. It had almost been sent to Tarawa, probably as a might have been towing an ammunition barge or something of that sort had it gone there. Tarawa had been captured by the Americans in November. And after Tarawa, I think the closest really serious action, as I say, I'm guessing, but I would say probably in the range of 1,500 miles from Midway.
That's some great context. And it just gives a sense of how big the theater of operations are in the World War II Pacific when we're casually throwing out thousands of miles of distance because it's essentially half planet Earth. Well, let's get to the protagonist of your book and learn about his background before getting to the particular story of the sinking of the Macaw. Can you tell us about the life of Paul Burton and what happened to him before this particular incident?
Yeah, a pretty remarkable life. Burton's father was a career Marine officer who was assigned several times to the Far East, on at least one occasion to Manila in the Philippines, and later to what was then called Peking. We call it Beijing now, the capital of China. And there, his job was to guard the American legation, the American diplomats. Burton actually did something like a year and a half of schooling around would be middle school or junior high school in the United States in China. He and his parents toured the Great Wall of China. Well, he was an experienced world traveler by the time he was in high school. He went back to the States after that. His father, I think, was subsequently assigned to Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. He went to Haverford prep school outside Philadelphia. He was on the track team. He was quite an athlete. His team in his senior year at Haverford won the mile relay at the Penn Relays, which is, I think to this day, it's the biggest high school track meet in the country. In 1929, despite the fact that one of the guys on the team, not Burton himself, dropped the baton. So it tells you something about the caliber of the team. He went to the Naval Academy. He was in the class of 33. The Depression had hit by the time he graduated. The military was subject to big personnel cutbacks and a pay cutback. I think as of 1933, the pay throughout the military, that applies to every branch, was reduced by some significant percentage. It might have been 20%. And the number of men graduating from the Naval Academy who were retained in the Navy was drastically reduced. I think they cut it by 50%. And the 50% that made the cut did so on the basis of their grades, basically, I think. And his grades, Paul Burton's, were good enough. He stayed in the Navy. He was assigned to a battleship. He requested submarine duty. He was trained in submarines. He had some ancillary activities. He took a mail course in, I think it was international law. He was approved for command of submarines. He trained on a submarine, was stationed temporarily in the Panama Canal Zone, and then was assigned to the USS Tarpon in the fall of 1942. The Tarpon had done, I believe, three or four war patrols by that point. It had a reputation as a bad luck boat. It had not done well. When Burton was assigned to it, it was also getting a new captain. That was Thomas Lincoln Wogan. Wogan was a Naval Academy graduate. He had graduated, I think, 3 years before Burton. I think they overlapped there by 1 year. And the two of them were on that boat for, I think, its fifth and sixth war patrols. Burton was the executive officer, so he was the second in command. The first patrol went very badly. They missed an opportunity to strike a real blow against some significant Japanese ships. They got a very bad review. Sometimes that would be enough to get, especially a novice skipper and maybe his executive officer, essentially blackballed out of submarines. But Wogan and Burton were given another chance. The second patrol went much better. They sank some Japanese ships, significant tonnage. They got back to Pearl Harbor. They were commended, but Wogan, for reasons that are not entirely clear, requested that Burton be blackballed out of submarines, and that request was approved. So Burton was then, in theory, promoted to command of another vessel, that being the Macaw, but in fact, that was a humiliating demotion. It's sort of like being reassigned from a glamorous combat vessel to what amounted to a tugboat.
Well, the reassignment is still going to see plenty of action, as we'll see in a second. What happened to the USS Flyer on January 16th, 1944? Can you describe that and whether or not these sorts of incidents were common?
Yeah. Well, in short, what happened was the Flyer ran aground at the entrance to the channel into the lagoon at Midway. The Flyer was supposed to be on its first war patrol. It had been built at New London, Connecticut. It had a very close brush with disaster as it was approaching Panama Canal. An American merchant vessel, an armed one, mistook it for a German submarine, fired 13 shells at it, unfortunately missed. So they survived to get to Hawaii and proceeded from Hawaii to Midway. They arrived at Midway on January 16th amid very rough conditions, and they proceeded to run aground attempting to enter the channel. There was a recommended starting point for making that entrance for a submarine to get into the channel. It's very narrow, rather a narrow channel. And that point was something like 2 or 2.5 miles off the entrance to the channel. The conditions were so rough that day on the 16th of January. Normally the procedure was that a harbor pilot would come out on a smaller craft, would board the submarine, and he would actually be the one essentially steering it into the channel. That day, they brought two boats out, but the pilot, they brought a very small one out at first, decided they needed a bigger one. The bigger one came out and decided, no, this wasn't going to work. So they instructed the flyer, which was on the surface at this point, to just follow them, rather than actually putting the harbor pilot on the flyer. Between the first and second boats coming out, Commander Crowley of the flyer decided that he would do the second boat a favor by coming in closer to the channel, saving that second boat that much more distance on a very rough sea. And the problem there was that when the flyer started to follow that second boat back into the channel, it had less distance between it and that boat. And Crowley was afraid that if he attempted to enter the channel at full speed, which would have been 15 knots, he might run the thing down. So he went in only at 10 knots, and that cost him a lot of his momentum, which you needed going through the surf. And basically what happened is that the surf outran the boat as he's approaching the channel, and the boat lost its forward thrust, essentially, and it was taken by a current off to the right, and it ran aground on the coral reef at the entrance to the channel.
From here, the Macaw goes to rescue the ship. So tell me about this, and how is the Macaw itself stranded?
Yeah, the Macaw had arrived 8 days before. The commanding officer at Midway at the time was Joseph Conley. He was a captain and quite high up in the naval hierarchy. He ordered Burton and the Macaw to go out to try to pull the flyer off the reef. Burton didn't want to go out, and I have that on the basis of one of the Macaw enlisted men who witnessed the conversation between them. Burton thought that it was entirely too rough to go out, and apparently his thinking was that it would be better to wait until the conditions calmed down and then try to rescue the submarine under more safer conditions. And Conley insisted, no, you're going out. And Conley went out with them. And the initial problem was they were having difficulty gauging the direction of the current at the channel. So the strategy initially was they wanted to float what's called a messenger to the submarine. And the basic objective here is to hook up a towing cable. A messenger is a light line that you somehow get from one vessel to another. And then once you establish that connection, the first vessel can reel in a heavier line from the second vessel. And you can repeat that procedure as many times as you need to get a big enough cable aboard the towing vessel to tow the other ship. To get the messenger to the submarine, they were trying to float it. And the direction in which the line would float, the line was buoyed up by little, what they call Kapok-like floats. In order to get the thing to float to the submarine, they have to know what direction the current is going, and they kind of misjudged that initially. They were south. The current was going from west to east, essentially, and they started more or less just south of the submarine. So the messenger that they were trying to float to it kept floating east of it. They finally sort of figured things out, decided that they would go back into the channel, come out of the channel a second time, and try to float the messenger from a point west of the submarine. And it was while they were trying to re-enter the channel to do that, they themselves ran aground.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So in this process, what happens over the next 3 weeks? How does the macaw try to get free, and why isn't it successful?
They try to tow it free. The first order of business was still getting the flyer off the reef. That was Conley's decision. A submarine makes a very dangerous vessel to be aground in because it's essentially a tube, and it has, I think, less resistance to capsizing than another vessel might. And also, it's of greater value in the actual combat against Japan than a submarine rescue vessel would be. So that was the first priority. And they did manage to get the flyer off the reef the following Saturday. So the two of them ran aground on Sunday, the 16th of January, and they got the flyer off the reef on the 22nd, Saturday. When they turned their attention to the macaw, they had all sorts of problems. The weather was generally very, very rough. They kept having towing cables snag on coral heads. At one point, a cable was severed, apparently by the propeller blade of a submarine coming into the lagoon. Yeah, it was just one thing and another. They were finally making what appeared to be good progress. After about 3 weeks, I believe it was a Thursday, and they managed to get the thing, it appeared largely buoyant and moving backwards, essentially, into deeper water. But then the weather picked up again. They put the operation on hold again, and then the weather got completely out of hand, and that's when it ended up sinking.
I'm curious, in the Pacific Ocean, were problems like this common, of running into coral reef and a ship being essentially taken out of service?
It was fairly common at Midway. That's the only place I really am sure about in that regard. But Midway had a very narrow entrance to the lagoon. Midway was an atoll. Many of the U.S. naval bases in the Pacific were atolls, which is basically a more or less circular coral reef and whatever lies inside. There was a very narrow channel that had been blasted through basically the south wall of the coral reef at Midway. And it was pretty strong current coming out of that channel that tended to run to the southeast. And so it was not unusual for ships to be swept to the east of the channel entrance and to run aground just east of the entrance, trying to get into that channel.
Well, the real action of your book is the rescue of the flyer and how the macaw is stranded. For the 3 weeks that the macaw is stranded, first of all, how did it get stranded? And what sort of hardships did the crew face over this period trying to free itself?
Well, it got stranded trying to get to a towing line to the flyer. There were very rough conditions that day. It was January 16th, 44. The flyer had originally hit the reef right at the mouth of the channel. John Crowley, the commander of the flyer, was concerned to essentially turn his submarine around and try to point the bow into the oncoming waves, which were coming basically from the southwest. And he managed to do that. He swung the boat 180 degrees. And as he was doing that, he was getting swept a little farther to the east. So the flyer ended up pinned with its stern to the reef about 100 yards east of the channel entrance. The macaw, in trying to get a line to it, ended up running aground right about where the flyer had originally hit the reef, which was right at really the eastern flare of the entrance to the channel. It was at, the macaw was actually on the reef for 4 weeks, and there was very rough weather much of that time. They had a lot of equipment failures. The lines that they were going to tow it free had a tendency to snag on the coral, what they call coral heads. So they had a lot of frustration, a lot of equipment failures. The men themselves had basically some medical wear and tear just from being exposed. It was chilly. They were wet much of the time. The ship was generally on an angle, so the stability, it was hard to maintain your balance. There were some falls. One man broke his jaw. By and large, the medical consequences were just too much exposure to the elements and fatigue.
Coming to the night when the ship is sinking, talk about this and, yeah, walk us through that night. This is where things really come to a head.
Yeah, well, let me start with the night before. So on Friday, February 11th, 44, the weather had picked up yet again. And when I say weather, I'm referring mainly to the sea condition. It wasn't necessarily raining or that windy. It was somewhat windy, but the real critical factor was the height and force of the waves. And the waves picked up pretty severely that Friday, badly enough that the various, well, there was two main salvage vessels that had been at work. There was the Florican, which was another submarine rescue vessel, one of the Macaw's sister ships, and basically a barge that was used that they were trying to establish the initial towing lines to. The idea being, I guess, they would hand the Macaw off to the Florican once they pulled it free from the reef. Those vessels had both gone back into the lagoon. It was deemed too rough to attempt salvage operations right then. And that weather, those waves, just kept getting worse as Friday passed into Saturday, and worse as Saturday progressed. By about 6 p.m. on Saturday, things were getting really pretty dire. The macaw it started to essentially slip backwards off the reef into deeper water. This was due to the waves, but actually the main factor there was the force of the current coming out of the entrance channel from the lagoon. The waves had pushed so much water over the relatively low western wall of the reef that you had this huge excessive, what they call, head of water in the lagoon, and it was basically leaving the lagoon via the entrance channel, and that southeast current at the mouth of the entrance channel was basically flowing broadside into the macaw, and that apparently is what dislodged it from its perch on the reef and started sinking it. As the night wore on, lots of problems. They took refuge in the pilot house, which was the highest enclosed chamber on the ship, aside from the little crow's nest. And there were all 22 men were in the pilot house by about, I think, 6 in the evening Saturday. By midnight, the pilot house was largely underwater. They had been trying to get oxygen through one of the portholes, and they were successful in doing that. They could open it between waves, but then as the ship slipped into deeper water, it was getting to the point where even between waves, they were submerged and had to close that porthole and were in danger both of drowning and asphyxiating because they were running out of breathable oxygen. And then by about 2:30 Sunday morning, February 13th, one man had blacked out, apparently from lack of oxygen, and the decision was made to leave the pilot house and try to get up to the foremast.
So what happens when Captain Paul Burton gives the order to abandon ship by opening the port side door and making for the foremast?
Well, the first problem was that the door would not open. It had apparently been warped by the strength of the waves that had been hitting it, and they had a real difficult time opening the thing. They finally managed to do that. The waves by that point had gotten enormous. There are various estimates to how big they are, ranging from about 25 feet to 50 feet, 50 feet being my dad's estimates that he later in a letter to his friend Jack McCarthy, 50 feet may have been an exaggeration, 25 feet probably understated it. It was big enough. These waves were literally tearing the ship apart. There was one big section of a protective shield that had been torn off. When the men went out of the pilot house at about, it was around 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, those waves were probably at about their height. And the objective, as I say, was to try to climb the foremast, which projected from the, essentially from the roof of the pilot house and provided the opportunity to get about as high on the ship as you possibly could in hopes of staying above the surface as the ship sank. A few of the men made it to the foremast. Three of them managed to climb it, but most of them were swept off by the waves between the pilot house and the foremast, or even once they had gotten to the foremast. I think there were some people just swept off by the waves.
So ultimately, what was the fate of different crew members of the Macaw?
Well, there were 22 men on board when it sank. 5 of those men died, presumably all by drowning. Although it's possible in the case of Robert Vaughn, who was a steward's mate from North Carolina, it's possible that he died from blunt force injury. Both my father and George Manning, who was a sailor from Eugene, Oregon, or it wasn't Eugene, a town in Oregon, they both saw him being smashed into the upright barrel of the biggest gun on the ship. It was in its locked upright position when he hit it. And apparently between the force of his body hitting it and the wave that propelled his body, it was knocked loose from its upright position. And both my dad and George Manning thought that Vaughn hit that thing so hard, he probably died on the impact. The other 4 men who died, presumably died by drowning. The 17 survivors took various routes to safety. There were 2 men who took refuge in the crow's nest, one on the foremast, I think just below the crow's nest, one on top of the what they called the tripod, which was a kind of a big erector set sort of construction that held both what they called the main mast and the ship's boom, essentially a crane that could lift 45,000 pounds. There were 6 men who ended up in a sort of circular support group in the water with their arms about one another. One of those men was Augie Paul Koepke, who was pretty badly injured. His shipmates kept him afloat. Another blacked out by early that morning, but they kept one another afloat. My dad and another sailor by the name of Nord Lester ended up on a buoy. There were various men who managed to swim or get washed either on the Eastern Island or there was a little islet in the entrance channel, one or two men managed to get there.
For those who survived, your father and others, what did they make of the experience? Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplug to 30605 and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplug to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplug to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
Well, it certainly, in my father's case, it was pretty clearly the most memorable episode for him in the war. He was on a couple of submarines after the Macaw. He had always wanted to be in submarines. My understanding from what he told me is that he failed a vision test early in the war, which was why they assigned him to a submarine rescue vessel instead. He was on two submarines, the Seal and the Sea Raven, after the Macaw. He saw combat. He did war patrols. And some of that was, I'm sure, rather hair-raising and memorable. But what was most memorable for him from the war was very clearly the sinking of the Macaw. The other men probably felt much the same. I know a number of them ended up being stationed for the rest of the war at Pearl Harbor, so they would having shore duty. So they'd have seen evidence of the fighting. A lot of them were repairing submarines that were coming back in from war patrols, but they themselves would probably never have had anything anywhere nearly as traumatic as the sinking that they had experienced with the Macaw at Midway. I think they were, what it meant to them exactly, you'd have to ask them, and it's too late to do that now, but I think that they were very grateful to have survived. The ones of a religious bent probably saw the hand of God at work in their survival. And really beyond that, I can't speak for them.
Well, your story brings out an aspect of World War II that is typically overlooked, that as much as soldiers fought against enemies and everyone faced danger, many died, an equally big enemy in many circumstances was nature. For all the pilots who faced storms, foggy weather, for the Navy men who faced storms like these. And you're also highlighting things like the underreported role of auxiliary vessels in war. So with these things in mind, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
Well, partly what you're getting at there is that there was a lot of really made the difference in the war was the efforts of men in a more or less auxiliary status. I read statistics about the ratio between basically support personnel and people actually engaged in active combat in wars, and whether this is wars in general, the United States World War II, I'm not sure, but it's a huge disproportion. You've got something like, I seem to recall, 20 or it might have been 50 or 100 people behind the scenes for every man or woman actually holding a gun in combat. And it's not as though the service that the auxiliary people provide, certainly during World War II, was without challenges or danger or heroism. And in this case, there were all of those. And when I say heroism, there were four men from the base at Midway who went out in rearming boats to try to rescue my dad and his shipmates when they were in the water, most of them, after the ship had sunk as much as it ever did. The foremast was still sticking out of the water even after it sank as far as it ever did sink. But the men on the foremast and in the water were very much in need of rescue. These four men, two men per rearming boat, went out in unauthorized rescue attempts because rearming boats are not really well suited to rough conditions. And they had been told not to go beyond the entrance to the channel. And they did. Both boats capsized. Three of the four men drowned. They gave their lives. They not only did not have to do what they did, they were not supposed to, according to strict military regulations. They knew that what they were doing was extremely dangerous. They did it anyhow, and three of those four men paid with their lives. So basically, there was plenty of drama, and there was heroism among the people who were behind the lines of the war, and this is an instance of that. And I'm hoping that my book underscores that point, gives people an appreciation for the role that support people basically played during the war.
Absolutely. Simply because somebody isn't facing active gunfire on a daily basis doesn't take away from their sacrifice. And in this case, their clear heroism to continue to support the war effort. Well, there is much more to the story that we couldn't get to. And for listeners who want to check that out, the name of Tim's book is A Strange Whim of the Sea, The Wreck of the USS Macaw. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode, and all my other ones as well, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support the show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.